morning. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is Wednesday, December 25th, 2019. Merry Christmas.
I'm sharing with you today a show I did 2 years ago about Christmas during the Civil War, and I believe I highlight both what took place in camp and also at the Confederate White House. Thank you so much, and have a great holiday. Hello, everybody. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is December 23rd, 2015. And today I want to do a show about Christmas during the Civil War. I'm reading from information found on the Civil War Trust website, and I'm going to share with you a couple of vignettes that are published there on that website. Guests can call me at 646-787-8231, and I will also add that this show will be archived once I'm finished. Let me get started. It can be difficult to relate to the men and women of the Civil War era. Despite the extraordinarily different circumstances in which they found themselves, however, we can connect with our forebearers in traditions such as the celebration of Christmas. By the mid-19th century, most of today's familiar Christmas trappings, Christmas carols, gift-giving, and tree decoration were already in place. Charles Dickens had published A Christmas Carol in 1843, and indeed, the Civil War saw the first introductions to in the modern image of a jolly and portly Santa Claus through the drawings of Thomas Nast, a German-speaking immigrant. Civil War soldiers in camp and their families at home drew comfort from the same sorts of traditions that characterize Christmas today. Alfred Ballard of the 5th New Jersey noted, in order to make it look much like Christmas as possible, a small tree was strung up in front of our tent, decked off with hardtack and pork in lieu of cakes and oranges, etc. John Haley of the 17th Maine wrote in his diary on Christmas Eve that it is rumored that there are sundry boxes and mysterious parcels over at Stoneman Station directed to us. We retire to sleep with feelings akin to those of children expecting Santa Claus. In one amusing anecdote, a Confederate prisoner relates how the realities of war intruded on his Christmas celebrations. And he continues, a friend had sent me in a package a bottle of old brandy. On Christmas morning, I quietly called several comrades up to my bunk to taste the precious fluid of disappointment. The bottle had been opened outside, the brandy taken and replaced with water, and sent in. I hope the Yankee who played that practical joke lived to repent it and was shot before the war ended. For many, the holiday was a reminder of the profound melancholy that had settled over the entire nation. Southern parents warned their children that Santa might not make it through the blockade, and soldiers in bleak winter quarters were reminded, more acutely than ever, of the domestic bliss they had left behind. Robert Gould Shaw, who would later earn glory as the commander of the 54th Massachusetts, recorded in his diary, it is Christmas morning, and I hope a happy and merry one for you all. Though it looks so stormy for our poor country, one can hardly be in merry humor. On the Confederate home front, Sally Brock Putnam of Richmond echoed Shaw's sentiment. Never before had so sad a Christmas dawned upon us. We had neither the heart nor inclination to make the week merry with joyousness when such a sad calamity hovered over us. For the people of Fredericksburg, Virginia, which had been battered only a matter of days before Christmas, or Savannah, Georgia, which General Sherman had presented to President Lincoln as a gift, The holiday season brought the war to their very doorsteps. Christmas during the Civil War served both as an escape from and a reminder of the awful conflict rending the country in two. Soldiers looked forward to a day of rest and relative relaxation, but had their moods tempered by the thought of separation from their loved ones. At home, families did their best to celebrate the holiday, but wondered when the vacant chair would again be filled. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show. I'm going to take a short break and be back after this, the following musical selection. Please listen. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show. And earlier on in my presentation, I talked about what soldiers did and what they got when they were in camp and their thoughts about Christmas during the Civil War. My next section will be a description written by Verina Davis, First Lady of the Confederacy, about Christmas in the Confederate White House in 1864. And she continues, "Rice, flour, molasses, and tiny pieces of meat, most of them sent to the president's wife anonymously to be distributed to the poor, had all to be weighed and issued, and the playtime of the family began. But, like a clap of thunder out of a clear sky, came the information that the orphans at the Episcopalian home had been promised a Christmas tree, and the toys, candy, and cakes must be provided, as well as one pretty prize for the most orderly girl among the orphans. The kind-hearted confectioner was interviewed by our committee of managers, and he promised a certain amount of his simpler kinds of candy, which he sold easily, $1.50 a pound. But he drew the line of cornucopias to hold it, or sugared fruits to hang on the tree, and all the other vestiges of Christmas creations which had lain on hands for years. The ladies dispersed in anxious squads of toy hunters, and each one turned over the store of her children's treasures for a contribution to the orphan's tree. My little ones rushed over the great house looking up their treasures. Eyeless dolls, three-legged horses, tops with the upper peg broken off, rubber tops, monkeys with all the squeak gone silent, and all the ruck of children's toys that gather in a nursery closet." And Mrs. Davis continues, "Some small feathered chickens and parrots, which nodded their heads in obedience to a weight beneath them, were furnished with new tail feathers. Lambs, minus much of their wool, were supplied with a cotton wool substitute. Rag dolls were plumped out and recovered with clean cloth, and the young ladies painted their fat faces in bright colors and furnished them with beads for eyes. But the tug of war was how to get something with which to decorate the orphan's tree. Our manservant, Robert Brown, was much interested and offered to make the prize toy. He contemplated a sure enough house with four rooms. His part in the domestic service was delegated to another girl, and he gave himself over in silence and solitude to the labors of the architect. My sister painted mantels, shelves, door panels, pictures, and frames for the walls, and finished with black grates in which there blazed a roaring fire, which was pronounced marvelously realistic. We all made furniture of twigs and pasteboard, and my mother made pillows, mattresses, sheets, and pillowcases for the two little bedrooms. Christmas Eve, a number of young people were invited to come and string apples and popcorn for the trees. A neighbor, very deft in domestic arts, had tiny candle molds made and furnished all the candles for the tree. How the puzzle and triumph of all was the construction of a large number of cornucopias. At last, someone suggested a conical block of wood about which the drawing paper would be wound and pasted. In a little bookshop, a number of small, highly colored pictures cut out and ready to apply were unearthed. And our old confectioner friend, Mr. Piazzi, consented, with a broad smile, to give all the love verses the young people wanted to roll with the candy. This is Jean Bartow with the Custer's Luck Radio Show. I'm taking another break and we'll be back in a moment and continue with Mrs. Davis's vignette. This is Jean Bartow with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is December 23rd, 2015, and I'm doing a show about Christmas and the Civil War. My section now is describing a Christmas party that Mrs. Davis, the First Lady of the Confederacy, had at her house, the White House of the Confederacy in Richmond, in December 1864, and also describes a party given to the orphans in an orphanage in Richmond. And my next section describes the Christmas Eve party. About 20 young men and girls gathered around small tables in one of the drawing rooms of the mansion, and the cornucopias were begun. The men wrapped the squares of candy, first reading the sentiments printed upon them, such as, "Roses are red, violets blue, sugar sweet, and so are you." And, "If you love me as I love you, no knife can cut our love in two." The fresh young faces, wreathed in smiles, nodded attention to the reading, while with their small deft hands they joined the cornucopias and pasted on the pictures. Where were the silk tops to come from? Trunks of old things were turned out, and snippets of silk and even woolen of bright colors were found to close the tops. And some of the young people twisted sewing silk into cords with which to draw the bags up. The beauty of these homemade things astonished us all, for they looked quite custom-made. But when the sure-enough house was revealed to our longing gaze, the young people clapped their approbation, while Robert, whose sense of dignity did not permit him to smile, stood the impersonation of a successful artist, and bowed his thanks for our approval. Then the coveted eggnog was passed around in tiny glass cups and pronounced good. Crisp homemade ginger snaps and snowy lady cake completed the refreshments of Christmas Eve. The children, allowed to sit up and be noisy in their way as an indulgence, took a sip of eggnog out of my cup, and the eldest boy confided to his father, "Now I know this is Christmas." In most of the houses in Richmond, the same scenes were enacted. Certainly in every one of the homes of the managers of the Episcopalian orphanage, a bowl of eggnog was sent to the servants, and a part of everything they coveted of the dainties. At last, quiet settled on the household, and the older members of the family began to stuff stockings with molasses candy, red apples, and orange, small whips plated by the family with high-colored crackers, worsted reins knitted at home, paper dolls, teetotums made of large horn bottoms, and a match which could spin indefinitely, balls of worsted rags wound hard and covered with old kid gloves, a pair of pretty woolen gloves for each, either cut out of cloth and embroidered on the back, or knitted by some deft hand out of homespun wool. For the president, there were a pair of chamois skin riding gauntlets, exquisitely embroidered on the back with his monogram in red and white silk, made, as the giver wrote, under the guns of Fortress Monroe late at night for fear of discovery. There was a hemstitched linen handkerchief with a little sketch in indelible ink in one corner. The children had written him little letters, their grandmother having held their hands, the burden of which compositions was how they loved their dear father. For one of the inmates of the home, who was greatly loved but whose irritable temper was his prominent failing, there was a pretty cravat, the ends of which were embroidered, as was the fashion of the day. The pattern chosen was simple, and on it was pinned a card with the word amiable to complete the sentence. One of the others received a present of an illuminated copy of Solomon's Proverbs found in the same old store from which the pictures came. He studied it for some time and announced, quote, "I have changed my opinion of Solomon. He uttered such unnecessary platitudes. Now, why should he have said, quote, 'The foolishness of a fool is his folly'?" On Christmas morning, the children awoke early and came in to see their toys. They were followed by the Negro women, who one after another caught us by wishing us a Merry Christmas before we could say it to them, which gave them a right to a gift. Of course, there was a present for everyone, small as though it may be, and one who had been born and brought up at our plantation was vocal in her admiration of a gay handkerchief. As she left the room, she stated, "Lord knows Mistress knows our insides. She just got the very thing I wanted." And Mrs. Davis, First Lady of the Confederacy, continues with her description. "For me, there were 6 cakes of delicious soap made from the grease of ham boiled for a family at Farmville, a skein of exquisitely fine gray linen thread spun at home, a pincushion cushion of some plain brown cotton material made by some poor woman and stuffed with wool from her pet sheep, and a little baby hat plaited by the orphans and presented by the industrious little pair who sewed the straw together. They pushed each other silently to speak, and at last mutely offered the hat, and considered the kiss they gave the sleeping little one ample reward for the industry, and far above the fruit with which they were laden. Another present was a fine, delicate little baby frock without an inch of lace or embroidery upon it, but the delicate fabric was set with fairy stitches by the dear invalid neighbor who made it, and it was very precious in my eyes. There were also a few of Swinburne's best songs bound in wallpaper, and a chamois needle book left for me by young Mr. P., now succeeded to his title in England. After breakfast, at which all the family, great and small, were present, came the walk to St. Paul's Church. We did not use our carriage on Christmas, or, if possible, to avoid it on Sunday. The saintly Dr. Minning Road preached a sermon on Christian love. The introit was sung by a beautiful young society woman, and the angels might have joyfully listened. Our chef did wonders with the turkey and roast beef, and drove the children quite out of their propriety by a spun sugar hen, life-size, on a nest full of blanc mange eggs. The mince pie and plum pudding made them feel, as one of the gentlemen laughingly remarked, like their jackets were buttoned, a strong description of repletion which I have never forgotten. They waited with great impatience and evident dyspeptic symptoms for the crowning amusement of the day, the children's tree. My eldest boy, a chubby little fellow of 7, came to me several times to whisper, "Do you think I ought to give the orphans my ID studs?" When told no, he beamed with the delight of an approving conscience. All throughout the afternoon, first one little head and then another popped in at the door to ask, "Isn't it 8 o'clock yet?" burning with impatience to see the children's tree. And this is Jean Bartow with the Custer Zuck Radio Show. I'm going to take another break and be right back and finish up with the rest of my vignette. Thank you. this is Jean Bartow with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and I am finishing up my show today with the description of Mrs. Davis's and her children's visit to the Episcopalian Orphans Home in Richmond. When, at last, we reached the basement of St. Paul's Church, the tree burst upon their view like the realization of Aladdin's subterranean orchard, and they were awed by its grandeur. The orphans sat mute with astonishment till the opening hymn and prayer, and the last amen had been said, and then they at their signal warily and slowly gathered around the tree to receive from a lovely young girl their allotted present. The different gradations from joy to ecstasy which illuminated their faces was worth 2 years of peaceful life to see. The president became so enthusiastic that he undertook to help in the distribution, but worked such wild confusion given everything asked for into their outstretched hands that we called a halt. So he contented himself with unwinding one or two tots from a network of strung popcorn in which they had become entangled, and taking off all apples he could when unobserved, and presenting them to the smaller children. When at last the house was given to the honor girl, she moved her lips without emitting a sound, but held it close to her breast, and went off in a corner to look and be glad without witnesses. When the lights were fled, the garlands dead, and all but we departed, we also went home to find that General Lee had called in our absence, and many other people. General Lee had left word that he had received a barrel of sweet potatoes for us, which had been sent to him by mistake. He did not discover the mistake until he had taken his share, a dishful, and given the rest to the soldiers. We wished it had been much more for them and him. And here is the conclusion of Mrs. Davis's vignette, which describes the officers in a starvation dance. The night closed with a starvation party in which there were no refreshments at a neighboring house. The rooms lighted as well as practicable, someone willing to play dance music on the piano, and plenty of young men and girls comprised the entertainment. Sam Weller's soiree, consisting of boiled mutton and capers, would have been a royal feast in the Confederacy. The officers, who rode into town with their long cavalry boots pulled up well over their knees, but splashed up to their waists, put up their horses and rushed to the places where their dress uniform suits had been left for safekeeping. They soon emerged, however, in full toggery, and entered into the pleasures of the dance with the bright-eyed girls, who many of them were as fragile as fairies, but worked like peasants for their home and country. These young people are gray-haired now, but the lessons of self-denial, industry, and frugality in which they became past mistresses then have made of them the most dignified, self-reliant, and tender women I have ever known, all honor to them. So, in the interchange of the courtesies and charities of life, to which we could not add its comforts and pleasures, passed the last Christmas in the Confederate mansion. And there is the finish of First Lady Verina Davis's vignette about her last Christmas in the Confederate White House in December of 1864. Thank you for listening to today's show about a Civil War Christmas, both on the Union and Confederate sides. I want to add that I will start doing more shows starting next week and going into January of 2018 and going further into the year so that I can increase my visibility on Blog Talk Radio and also increase my knowledge about the Civil War and specifically about George Armstrong Custer. I look forward to your listening and your constructive feedback, and I hope that you will register your comments on my show on the Blog Talk Radio website. Thank you for listening. Merry Christmas.
I will be back with more content later this week. And here is a special song for the season. I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem he wrote in 1863 and now put to music by counting crows.
I heard the bells on Christmas Day. They're old familiar carols play, and mild and sweet their songs repeat, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And the bells are ringing in my heart. Like a choir singing, peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. But the bells are ringing, peace, like a choir singing, peace. Does anybody hear this? Peace on earth. Shall fail, the right will fail. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then ringing, singing on its way, the world revolved from night. A voice, a chime, a chant sublime, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. For the bells are ringing, like a choir singing, and our hearts will hear this. Peace.